Hello, and welcome to the Learning College. My name is Alex Linder, and you can find this and everything we record at vnnforum.com. Today we're going to do Chapter 11 of Volume 2 of Adolf Hitler's Mein Kampf, Thomas Dalton translation. Chapter 11 is called Propaganda and Organization, and this will be recording number 30. Begins on page 629, Chapter 11, Volume 2, Propaganda and Organization. This is a pretty short chapter, so it won't take too awful long. Try to do the full chapter where I can, or split it into two parts if it's 20 sections or more. So, Chapter 11, Volume 2, Propaganda and Organization. The year 1921 was especially important for me and the movement. It began in September 1919, so that'd be its third year. When I entered the German Workers' Party, I immediately took charge of propaganda. I regarded this branch as by far the most important. For the time being, it was less a matter of racking one's brains over organizational problems than of spreading our ideas to a large number of people. Propaganda must go well ahead of organization and gather together the human material to be worked upon. I'm an enemy of hasty and pedantic organizing. It usually results in merely a dead mechanism and only rarely a living organization. Organization is something that owes its existence to organic life, to organic development. Ideas that have gripped a certain number of people tend to form some degree of order, and out of this inner formation comes something very valuable. Here, too, one must take into account of those human weaknesses that make men hesitate, especially at the beginning, to submit to a superior mind. If an organization is mechanically organized from above, there's always the danger that some unevaluated person will press forward and, out of jealousy, try to hinder abler persons from rising in the movement. The damage that results from that kind of thing can have terrible consequences, especially in a young movement. 11.1. Theoretician, organizer, agitator. For this reason, it's advisable at first to propagate the ideas on which the movement is founded from a central point, and then to sift through the gathering human material to look for leading minds. It sometimes happens that apparently insignificant men will nevertheless turn out to be born leaders. But it would be quite a mistake to suppose that those who show an intelligent grasp of theory thus possess leadership qualities and abilities. The contrary is often the case. Great theoreticians are only very rarely great organizers. So a big distinction between theoretical organization and actual organizing. The greatness of the theorist and system founder consists in the recognition and establishment of abstract and correct laws, whereas the organizer must first of all be a psychologist. He must take men as they are, and therefore must know them. He must not have too high or too low an estimate of human nature. On the contrary, he must take account of their weaknesses and bestiality so as to form a living organism endowed with strong powers of resistance, suited to be the carrier of an idea, and strong enough to ensure its success. Even more rarely is a great theorist also a great leader. The latter is more likely an agitator, a fact that those who deal with questions scientifically will not want to hear, and yet this is understandable. An agitator who shows himself capable of transmitting ideas to the broad masses must always be a psychologist, even though he may only be a demagogue. Therefore, he will always be a much more capable leader than the theorist who is abstract and alienated from the people. Being a leader means to be able to move the masses. The gift of formulating ideas has nothing to do with leadership abilities. It would be useless to discuss the question as to which is the more important, to set up ideals and human aims, or to realize them. Here, as so often in life, one would be entirely meaningless without the other. The noblest conceptions of human understanding remain without purpose or value if the leader cannot move the masses towards them. And conversely, What would it avail to have all the genius and energy of a leader if the intellectual theorist doesn't set the aims for which mankind must struggle? But when the theorist, organizer, and leader are united in one person, then we have the rarest phenomenon on this earth. This combination creates the great man. Theorist, organizer, and leader, and he's describing himself. But never saying it, just pointing out that, see, he understands all this and has the ability. I thought I could speak, now I knew I could speak. He knows he can speak. He knows he's physically brave from his work in World War I. He studied history. He understands that the leaders, where they went wrong and what should have been done. So he is this person he's describing, a great man, and the rarest phenomenon on earth. 11.2, propaganda and organization. As I've already said, during my first period in the party, I devoted myself to propaganda. I had to gather together a small nucleus of men who would accept the new doctrine and in this way provide the human material that subsequently would form the elements of the organization. Thus, the goal of propaganda lay far beyond that of the organization. If a movement proposes to overthrow a certain world order and construct a new one in its place, then the leader must clearly understand the following principles. Every movement that has gained its human material must first divide them into two groups, supporters and members. The function of propaganda is to attract supporters. The function of organization is to win members. That's the inside people, the members, and the supporters are very broad outside. A movement supporter is one who understands and accepts its aims. The member is the one who fights for them. And that is well worth remembering. In fact, I'm going to tweet that out in Pieville. A movement supporter is one who understands and accepts its aims. The member is the one who fights for them. The supporter is one who has been converted to the movement through propaganda. The member is one who will be charged by the organization to collaborate in winning over new supporters from whom new members can be formed. Supporters need only a passive recognition of the idea, while membership demands an active advocacy and defense. For every 10 supporters, there will be at most one or two members. Supporters are rooted only in understanding. Membership implies the courage to actively participate in diffusing that which has been understood through the rallies and outreach and fighting, so forth, fighting that attends all that. In its passive form, understanding is sufficient for the majority of humanity who are generally lazy and timid. Membership requires intellectual activity and therefore applies only to a minority of men. This is all hugely important stuff. This is a very short chapter, but it's, you know, it's dense. This is the point. So he's making a very clear distinction between supporters and members. Supporters are those you've reached through your propaganda who understand what you're saying and agree with it. And there it ends. They might send you a check to help your work, but other than that, and they might talk about it some on their own, but not formally, only informally. They're supporters. They might subscribe to your paper, your monthly newsletter, whatever, but they're not members. The members are the ones who are part of the organization, specific tasks, and are willing to fight, and more generally, more diffusely, to go out and talk to people and convert and raise new supporters. And he's saying the ratio is about 10 to 1, or not really less than that. Membership requires intellectual activity and therefore applies only to a minority of men. That is, they think about it. They not only accept the idea, they realize it will be an important part of their life to fight for it, even if it costs them their life. Consequently, propaganda must seek to win new supporters for an idea, whereas the organizer must diligently seek out the best among them and turn them into members. And this is what, like, Pierce was trying to do with the National Alliance, for instance. Propaganda need not trouble itself about the importance of each individual regarding his ability, capacity, understanding, or character, whereas the organization will have to carefully select those elements that are most capable of actively bringing the movement to victory. So with propaganda, you're just trying to reach as many as you can, and its level is aimed at the lowest mental level, the mental level of the lowest person you're trying to reach. But when you're organizing and collecting actual members, you need to be very careful in sifting through to get people who are very smart, very loyal, very dedicated, and very able, very mentally strong. Propaganda aims at inducing a whole people to accept a teaching. Organization includes in its scope only those who, on psychological grounds, won't be an impediment to the further diffusion of the idea. Propaganda works on the whole from the standpoint of an idea, preparing the way for its victory, whereas the organization achieves victory through the persistent, organic, and militant union of those supporters who have proven willing and able to carry the struggle to victory, i.e. the members, maybe the members leading the supporters at some point when it gets farther down the road. An idea's victory will be made all the easier if propaganda has effectively converted the people as a whole, and if the organization that actively conducts the fight is focused, vigorous, and unwavering. As a result, there's no limit to the number of supporters, but the number of members can more easily be too large than too small. When propaganda has converted a whole people to an idea, the organization can draw the consequences with a mere handful of men. Propaganda and organization, therefore, supporter and member, then stand in definite mutual relationship. The better the propaganda has worked, the smaller can be the organization. The greater the number of supporters, the smaller can be the number of members. And conversely, the poorer the propaganda, the larger the necessary organization. And the smaller the number of the movement's supporters, the larger the membership must be if it really counts on being successful. The first task of propaganda is to win over people for subsequent organization, and the first task of organization is to win men who can continue the propaganda. The second task of propaganda is to disrupt the existing order of things and thus make room for the penetration of the new doctrine, while the second task of the organization must be the struggle for power, so that the doctrine may finally triumph. Get the right men and then fight to win for the organization and persuade the people and attack the existing state of things for propaganda. A philosophical revolution will always achieve decisive success when the new worldview has been taught to all men or subsequently forced upon them if necessary. Whereas the organization of the idea, that is, the movement is the organization of the idea, must embrace only those few men who are absolutely indispensable for occupying the nerve centers of the coming state. In other words, this means the following. In every great world-altering movement, the idea of this movement must always first be spread by propaganda. In every great world-altering movement, the idea of this movement must always first be spread by propaganda. It must relentlessly attempt to make the new ideas clearly understood, drawing others to its ground, or at least to make them uncertain of their prior convictions. Since the dissemination of an idea, that is, propaganda, needs a backbone, it must be based on a solid organization. The organization chooses its members from among those supporters won by propaganda. That organization will grow faster if the work of propaganda is intensively promoted, and the propaganda will work all the better when the organization behind it is powerful and strong. Hence, the organization's highest task is to ensure that any discord that may arise among the movement's members won't lead it to a split and thereby weakens its work. Moreover, it's the organization's duty to see that the fighting spirit does not die out, but is constantly renewed and strengthened. The number of members need not grow indefinitely. On the contrary, since only a fraction of humanity is energetic and courageous, a movement that increases its own organization indefinitely must necessarily become weak. That's important. He's saying quality matters, not quantity. The number of members need not grow indefinitely. On the contrary, since only a fraction of humanity is energetic and courageous, a movement that increases its own organization indefinitely must necessarily become weak, like a government. Just a bunch of garbage there for bad reasons. Organizations, that is to say, groups of members that grow beyond certain dimensions, gradually lose their fighting force and are no longer able to aggressively support the propaganda of an idea. The greater and more revolutionary an idea is, the more active will be its members, because a doctrine's subversive force becomes a danger to the small-minded and faint-hearted. Some will privately be supporters, but are afraid to acknowledge their belief publicly. By reason of this very fact, however, an organization inspired by a veritable revolutionary idea will attract into its membership only the most active of those supporters who have been won over by propaganda. It's precisely in this activity of the movement's membership, guaranteed by natural selection, that we may find the preconditions for the continuation of an active propaganda and also the victorious struggle for the realization of the idea. 11.3, limitation of membership. The greatest danger that can threaten a movement is an abnormal increase in the number of its members due to its too rapid success. So long as a movement is carrying on a bitter fight, people of weak and egotistic temperament will shun it. But these same will rush to be accepted as members the moment the party achieves a manifest success through its development. This is why so many movements that were initially successful slowed down before fulfilling their purpose and, from an inexplicable inner weakness, gave up the struggle and finally died out. As a result of their early successes, so many undesirable, unworthy, and especially timid individuals entered the organization that they finally secured the majority over the militants. They then turned the movement to the service of their personal interest, debased it to the level of their own miserable heroism, and no longer struggled for the triumph of the original idea. The fanatical goal was lost, and the fighting force paralyzed, or, as the bourgeois world says in such cases, the wine has been mixed with water. When that happens, trees no longer grow to the heavens. And in a different way, he's talking about Sam Adams, a small, tiny, irate minority keeps a fire going in the mind, set fire in people's minds. It is therefore necessary that a movement should, from a sheer instinct for self-preservation, block its enrollments the moment it becomes successful. And any further increase in its organization should be allowed to take place only with the most careful foresight and after a painstaking sifting of those who apply for membership. This is the only way to keep the kernel of the movement truly fresh and sound. Care must be taken that the movement is led exclusively by this core, that is, that it must direct the propaganda that aims at a universal recognition. And with power secured in hand, it must undertake the actions necessary for the practical realization of its ideas. The original core should occupy all the important positions of the conquered territory and should form the basis of the entire leadership. This should continue until the party principles and doctrines have become the foundation and policy of the new state. Only then can the reins be gradually handed over to the constitutional state that the movement has created. But this usually happens through a process of mutual rivalry because it's less a question of human intelligence than of the play and effect of forces whose development can be guided, perhaps, but never controlled. You got to just see how things play out. All great movements, whether of a political or religious nature, owe their imposing success to the recognition and adoption of these principles. And all lasting success is inconceivable without observing these laws. So don't let the half-hearted rush in the moment you have your first success. Frightening the faint-hearted. As propaganda director for the party, 11-4, frightening the faint-hearted, as propaganda director for the party, I took care not only to prepare the ground for the movement's future greatness, but I also adopted the most radical measures to ensure that the organization acquired only the best material. The more radical and inflammatory my propaganda was, the more it frightened away any weak and hesitant characters, thus preventing them from entering the core of our organization. Perhaps they remained supporters, but not loudly. Rather, they were discreetly silent about the fact. Many thousands assured me at that time that they were in full agreement with us, but that they could, on no account, become members. They said that the movement was so radical that membership would expose them to the gravest difficulties and dangers so that they would continue on as honest and peaceful citizens and remain aside for now, though at heart devoted to our cause. And that was good. If all these men who, in their hearts, were not in favor of the revolution, became party members at that time, we would be seen today as a pious fraternity and not as a young militant movement. The lively and combative form that I gave to all our propaganda fortified and guaranteed the radical tendency of our movement. The result was that, with a few exceptions, only radicals were ready for membership. Within a short time, this propaganda had the effect that hundreds of thousands became convinced in their hearts that we were right and wished us victory, even though they were personally too timid to make sacrifices for our cause or even participate in it. Yeah, it's the cowardly conservatives. 11-5, reorganization of the movement. Up to the middle of 1921, this simple activity sufficed to benefit the movement. But in the summer of that year, certain events happened that suggested that the organization should be aligned with the gradual success of the propaganda. An attempt by a group of focused dreamers, supported by the then party chairman, to take over leadership led to the breakup of this little intrigue. By unanimous vote, at a general meeting, members gave me leadership of the whole movement. At once, a new statute was passed that invested sole responsibility in the chairman of the movement. It also replaced the committee decision process with the system of division of labor, which has worked excellently since then. So, again, in line with his principles, one man has complete authority, and the same man has complete responsibility. Instead of committee decisions, they have a division of labor, which has worked excellently, he says. From 1 August 1921 onwards, I undertook this internal party reorganization and was supported by a number of excellent men, whom I will mention later on. In my attempt to turn the results of propaganda to an organizational advantage and thus to stabilize them, I had to abolish a number of old habits and introduce principles that none of the other parties possessed or would even have recognized. In the years from 1920 to 1921, the movement was controlled by a committee that elected by the members at a general meeting. It had a first and second treasurer, a first and second secretary, and a first and second chairman at its head. Additionally, there was a membership secretary, propaganda director, and various committeemen. Strangely enough, the committee actually embodied that which the movement was fighting against, namely parliamentarianism. It was obvious that this principle embodied the very system under which we all suffered, and still suffer, from the smallest local groups, through the districts, counties, and provinces, up to the Reich leadership. It was imperative to change this if the poor foundation in the internal organization was not to ruin the movement forever, thus making it impossible to fulfill its high mission. Committee sessions were ruled by a protocol in which decisions were made according to majority vote, presenting in reality a miniature parliament. Here, too, there was no such thing as a personal responsibility. Here, too, reigned the same absurdities and unreasonableness as in our great state representative bodies. Secretaries, treasurers, membership secretaries, propaganda agents, and God knows what else were named. And then they all deliberated together on every single question and decided it by vote. Accordingly, the propaganda man voted on things that concerned the finance man, and the latter in turn voted on things that concerned only the organization, and the organizer voted on things concerning only the secretary, and so on. Why appoint a special man for propaganda if treasurers, secretaries, etc. could deliver judgment on questions concerning it? To one with a sound mind, such a thing seems as incomprehensible as it would be if, in a great industrial firm, the board of directors of engineers were to decide on questions that they had nothing to do with. I refused to submit to that kind of nonsense, and after a while I avoided the meetings. I did only my propaganda work and didn't permit any incompetent to poke his head into my activities. Conversely, I didn't interfere in the affairs of others. 11.6. Responsibility of the leader. When the new statute was approved and I was appointed as first chairman, I had the necessary authority and right to end all that nonsense. In place of committee decisions, the principle of absolute responsibility was introduced. The chairman is responsible for overall control of the movement. He apportions the work among the committee members under him and among others as needed. Each of these gentlemen is solely responsible for the task assigned to him. He is subordinate only to the chairman, whose duty is to supervise overall coordination by selecting personnel and giving general directions for this. This law of fundamental responsibility is gradually being adopted throughout the movement, at least within the party leadership. In the small local groups, and perhaps in the counties and districts, it will take years before this principle can be imposed because cowards and incompetents are naturally opposed to it. For them, sole responsibility for an act is always unpleasant. After every hard decision, they always feel freer and better when hiding behind the majority of a so-called committee. But it seems to me necessary to take a decisive stand against that view. We must not make any concessions to cowardice in the face of responsibility, even though it takes some time to achieve a conception of a leader's duty and ability. Ultimately, this will bring forth leaders who are truly called and chosen for the role. In any case, a movement that wants to fight against this parliamentary nonsense must be immune from this sort of thing. Only thus will it win the strength for its struggle. At a time when the majority rule dominates all, a movement that's based on the principle of the leader ideal, hyphenated leader ideal, a movement based on leader ideal and the corresponding responsibility will one day overcome the present situation and emerge victorious. This is a mathematical certainty. 11.7. Building a movement. This idea made it necessary to internally reorganize our movement. The logical development of this led to a sharp distinction between the business activities of the movement and the general political leadership. The principle of personal responsibility was extended to all party activities, bringing a healthy liberation from political influences and allowing them to operate solely on economic principles. When I joined the six-man party in the fall of 1921, we had neither headquarters nor clerks, nor forms, or even a stamp, and no printed material of any sort. I thought it was 1919, not 1921. The committee at first met in a tavern on the Herrengasse, and then in a cafe on Gasteig. It was an impossible condition. I quickly set to work, going around to several Munich restaurants and taverns with the idea of renting a room for use by the party. In the former Sternecker Brau on Tal, there was a small room with an arched roof in the Sternecker Brau that had previously been used as a sort of festive tavern for the Bavarian councillors. It was gloomy and dark, and accordingly as well suited to its former uses as it was ill-suited to its new purpose. Its only window looked out on an alley that was so narrow that the room remained dim and gloomy even on the brightest summer day. This was our first business office. Rent came to 50 marks per month, an enormous sum for us, but we couldn't make many demands. We dared not complain even when, before we moved in, they removed the wooden paneling that was intended for the imperial councillors. The place began to look more like a basement vault than an office. Still, it marked an enormous step forward. Slowly we got electric light, and slower still a telephone, a table, and some borrowed chairs were finally brought in, finally an open bookstand, and later a closet, Two cupboards belonging to the landlord held our leaflets, posters, etc. The previous system of running the movement with weekly leadership meetings was unsustainable. Only a paid official of the movement could guarantee ongoing operation. But that was difficult at the time. The movement still had so few members that it was hard to find among them a suitable person who would make few demands for himself and yet could meet the innumerable demands of the movement. After a long search, we found a soldier, an old war comrade of mine, Schuster, to be our first business manager. At first, he came to our new office daily between 6 and 8 p.m., later from 5 to 8, and ultimately every afternoon. Finally, it became a full-time job, and he worked from morning until late at night. He was an industrious, upright, and thoroughly honest man, faithful and devoted to the movement itself. Schuster brought with him his own small Adler typewriter. It was the first machine to be used in the service of the movement. Later, the party acquired it through installment payments. We needed a small safe in order to protect our papers and membership rolls from thieves. It certainly wasn't needed for any large sum of money that we might have had. On the contrary, we were always poor, and I often contributed from my own small savings. A year and a half later, our business office had become too small, so we moved to a new place in the Corneliusstrasse. Again, our office was in a tavern, but instead of one room, we now had three smaller rooms and one large room with great windows. At the time, it was very nice. We stayed there until November 1923. In December 1920, we acquired the Focusher Beobachter. Beobachten is a verb meaning to observe, so the People's Observer, footnote 180. Literally, the People's Observer. This newspaper, which, as its name implies, championed Focus interests, was now to become the organ of the NSDAP. At first it appeared twice weekly, but it became a daily at the start of 1923, and by late August 1923 appeared in the well-known large format. So within 4 or 5 years, they got their own daily paper, and that is a huge, huge deal to produce. As a complete novice to journalism, I learned many a costly lesson, says Hiller. The fact that, in contrast to the enormous Jewish press, there was hardly a single significant Focus newspaper was a matter of concern. As I later learned by experience, the reason for this can be attributed to the incompetent management of the so-called Focus enterprises. These were conducted too much according to the view that conviction should prevail over achievement. A totally wrong standpoint, because conviction of itself is something internal and is best expressed in achievement. The man who does valuable work for his people expresses his valuable convictions, whereas another who merely talks about convictions and does nothing really useful for his people is opposed to real conviction, and his conviction is a burden for the community. The Focusher Beobachter was a so-called Focus organ, as its name indicates. It had all the advantages, but still more the faults and weaknesses, inherent in all Focus institutions. We've heard him criticize Focus stuff earlier. Though its contents were sincere, its business management was simply impossible. Here, too, the underlying idea was that Focus newspapers should be subsidized by Focus contributions without recognizing that it had to compete with the others and that it was dishonest to expect the subscriptions of good patriots to make up for negligence or errors. As soon as I recognized these conditions, I promptly tried to eliminate them. Luck was on my side here, insofar as it brought me the man who, since that time, has rendered invaluable services to the movement, not only as a business manager of the paper, but also the party. In 1914, in the battlefield, I made the acquaintance of Max Amann, A-M-A-N-N, Max Amann, who is today general business manager of the party, footnote 181. Amann, 1891 to 1957, ultimately became the head of the NSDAP press office, overseeing all official publications. He survived World War II, was captured, and spent 10 years in a prison camp. It was Amann who suggested to Hitler the title of the present work. Mein Kampf. During the 4 years in the war, I had occasion to continually observe the unusual ability, diligence, and rigorous conscientiousness of my future collaborator, Max Amann. In mid-summer 1921, when the movement was in a grave crisis, I turned to my old regimental comrade, whom I met one day by chance, and asked him to become business manager of the movement. I was quite dissatisfied with several of our employees, particularly with one of whom I had had a very bitter experience. After a long hesitation, Amann then held a good position. He agreed to my request, but only on the condition he not be at the mercy of incompetent committees. Rather, he wanted to answer only to one single leader. It is to the inestimable credit of this first business manager of the movement, a man of comprehensive business knowledge, that he brought order and integrity into the party's business affairs. Since then, these have remained exemplary and unequaled by any other great branches of the movement. But, as often happens in life, great ability provokes envy and disfavor. That also had to be expected in this case and borne patiently. Already by 1922, firm regulations existed for both the commercial and purely organizational development of the movement. There now exists a central filing system covering all enrolled members. Financing of the movement is now to be on a sound basis. Current expenses are covered by current receipts, and special receipts can be used only for special expenditures. Thus, notwithstanding the difficulties of the time, the movements remain practically debt-free, except for small current accounts. Indeed, there was even a steady increase in the funds. Things work as in a private business. Employees hold their jobs by virtue of their achievement and can in no sense take cover behind that famous conviction. You know, performance matters. You can't get away, oh, well, I'm pro-white. Doesn't excuse being incompetent. The conviction of every National Socialist lies in his willingness to work and in his diligence and ability at accomplishing the duties assigned to him by the community. He who doesn't fulfill his duty in the job he holds cannot boast of his conviction, against which, in reality, he sins. Opposing all possible influences and with the utmost energy, the new business manager firmly supported the view that there were no meaningless positions in the party administration for supporters and members who don't want to work. A movement that fights so sharply against party corruption of our civil service must keep its own apparatus pure of such vices. It happened that some men were taken on the staff of the paper who had formerly been adherents of the Bavarian People's Party, but their work showed that they were excellently qualified for the job. The result of this experiment was generally outstanding. It was owing to this honest and frank recognition of individual efficiency that the movement won the hearts of its employees more swiftly and more profoundly than had ever before been the case. Subsequently, they became good National Socialists and remained so, not only in word, but they proved it by the conscientious, steady, and honest work that they performed in the service of the new movement. Naturally, a well-qualified party member was preferable to another, equally qualified but non-party member, but no one got a position based solely on party membership. They had to be able to do the work. The firmness with which our new business manager applied these principles and gradually enforced them, despite all opposition, later worked to the movement's greatest advantage. To this alone was it possible, during the difficult inflation period, when thousands of businesses failed and thousands of newspapers closed, for the movement's leadership to not only keep the business afloat and meet all its obligations, but also to steadily expand the Völkischer Beobachter. It thereby ranked among the great newspapers. The year 1921 was of further importance because, in my position as party chairman, I gradually succeeded in ending the criticisms and the intrusions of many committee members regarding various party activities. This was important because we couldn't get a capable man to take on a job if incompetents were constantly interfering, pretending that they knew better than anyone else, and creating a hopeless mess. Then these know-it-alls modestly retired, seeking another field for their inspiring supervisory activities. Some men seem to have a pathology for looking for something behind everything. They were, so to say, always pregnant with magnificent plans, ideas, projects, and methods. Naturally, their noble aims and ideals were always the formation of a committee that could pretend to be a controlling organ in order to nose its way into the serious work of others. But it's offensive and un-National Socialist when incompetent people constantly interfere in the work of capable persons. But this doesn't even enter their consciousness. In any case, I felt it my duty in those years to protect all those who were entrusted with regular and responsible work from such elements, to give them cover and to leave them free to do their work. Such committees, which either did nothing or cooked up impractical decisions, were best made harmless by giving them real work to do. It was then laughable to see how the membership would silently fade away and was suddenly nowhere to be found. It made me think of our great institution of the same kind, the Reichstag. How quickly they would evaporate if they had some real work to do instead of talking, especially if each of those braggarts were made personally responsible for the work assigned to him. I always demanded that, just as in private life, so too in the movement, we should keep seeking until we found a capable and honest clerk, administrator, or leader for the various business units. Once installed in his position, he was given absolute authority and full freedom of action toward his subordinates, but full responsibility towards his superiors. No one was placed in authority over his subordinates unless he himself do the work better than they. In the course of 2 years, I put my views more and more into practice. Today, at least concerning the highest leadership, they are taken for granted. The visible success of this attitude was shown on 9 November 1923. 4 years earlier, when I entered the movement, it didn't even have a rubber stamp. On 9 November 1923, the party was dissolved and its property confiscated. The total sum of all the objects of value in the newspaper amounted to more than 170,000 gold marks. So they put that up in 4 years while propagating a brand new idea and creating a brand new movement. And then he's in jail. He gives him time to speak out this book. And then he gets out and makes world history. So as I said, it was a fairly short chapter. It's been recording 30 out of Thomas Dalton's Mein Kampf by Adolf Hitler, of course. And it's been volume 2. Chapter 11 we have just completed. So thanks for being with me, and I'll be back with you for more from the same real soon.